On this week's 51%, we discuss a Texas lawsuit targeting a New York telemedicine provider who prescribed abortion pills.
This is a question about states' rights and when states have to listen to one another.
We also get some tips on how to de-stress this holiday season and learn about the genius of empathy with Dr. Judith Orloff. I'm Jesse King. It's all up next on 51%.
I was standing around like one of those girls I had seen in a movie. The whole world was a movie back then. I had my sunglasses on, I wanted to be seen without seeing Shiloh or Lita. I wasn't really in it, I didn't really get it.
You're listening to 51%, a WAMC production dedicated to women's issues and experiences. Happy holidays, and thanks for joining us. I'm Jesse King. I had hoped to keep this week a little lighter, celebrate the holidays and the end of the year, but it seems the state of Texas had other plans. Recently, Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton filed a civil lawsuit in federal court against Dr. Maggie Carpenter of New Paltz, New York, for prescribing abortion pills to a Texas patient via telemedicine. Texas bans nearly all abortions at all stages of pregnancy. According to the filing, it was the father in the pregnancy who discovered the abortion after the woman experienced complications that prompted her to go to the hospital. The lawsuit is one of the first trying to prevent telemedicine providers from mailing abortion pills to states that ban it. Mifepristone and misoprostol are used to end pregnancy up to 12 weeks and were responsible for more than half of all abortions in the U.S. last year. But the case is also the first test of New York's SHIELD law, designed to protect doctors and abortion advocates from retaliation. Here to help us understand the case better is Mary Ziegler, the Martin Luther King Jr. Professor of Law at the University of California, Davis. Ziegler is one of the leading historians on the U.S. abortion debate, with 7 books on the subject. She says a case like this was probably only a matter of time, given the patchwork of abortion laws that have resulted from the Supreme Court's reversal of Roe v. Wade in 2022.
Texas is arguing that Dr. Carpenter, who, as you mentioned, is based in New York, violated Texas's laws on practicing medicine without a license and Texas's abortion ban, which applies to abortion pills. This is a civil lawsuit. They're not prosecuting Dr. Carpenter. They're seeking civil penalties against her, including under one law that allows for, you know, a minimum of $100,000 penalty per violation. So that in a nutshell is what the lawsuit is about.
Okay. And I should say Dr. Carpenter did not personally respond to a request for comment from WAMC, but in a statement, the coalition she co-founded, called the Abortion Coalition for Telemedicine, asserted mifepristone and misoprostol are safe and that, quote, Ken Paxton is prioritizing his anti-abortion agenda over the health and well-being of women by attempting to shut down telemedicine abortion nationwide, end quote. But, you know, this case is specifically a test of New York's SHIELD law, which is supposed to protect abortion providers in that state. Tell me a little bit more about what a SHIELD law is and what this specific law in New York does.
So SHIELD laws are designed to protect doctors and other defendants like abortion funds, donors, drivers, friends, family from legal consequences if they help abortion seekers from out of state, either by doing things for them while they remain in those states or if they travel out of state seeking abortion services. And they haven't been tested so far. There are 23 states in Washington, D.C. that have introduced these SHIELD laws since 2023 alone, but they haven't been tested in federal court, and that's what we're expecting to see with this case.
And so what are some of the different ways that this can play out?
Well, there are a lot of unanswered questions, right? I mean, so New York SHIELD law primarily deals with lawsuits like this, both by ensuring that there won't be cooperation with an investigation or a discovery request from Texas or other plaintiffs like it, and by saying that if you sue someone for what's protected in New York, they can sue you right back. That's going to be more complicated in this case because Texas, like a lot of other states, it's harder to sue because of the 11th Amendment of the Constitution. So if Texas is doing the suing, there'll be a lot of complicated legal questions in state court, like whether Texas even has the right to bring Dr. Carpenter to court, There'll be questions about whether Texas should apply Texas law or New York law to resolve all the questions that the lawsuit raises. And there'll be questions of, even if Ken Paxton wins in the Texas courts, whether that judgment will ever actually be enforced against Dr. Carpenter. So if Dr. Carpenter never sets foot in the state of Texas, will New York courts enforce a judgment against her? And that's going to create constitutional questions that will ultimately be resolved by the U.S. Supreme Court.
Oh, so this is going to land at the Supreme Court in one way or another.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. I know we're getting pretty far into predictions and hypotheticals now, but, you know, what is the Supreme Court's appetite for a case like this right now? You know, they dismissed a case earlier this year challenging the FDA's approval for mifepristone.
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously the Supreme Court is conservative, and that makes predictions, you know, challenging. This is a different question because, of course, this is a question about states' rights, right? And when states have to listen to one another. Generally speaking, when one state's courts reach a final judgment, the other states have to honor that judgment for reasons that kind of make sense. It would be pretty difficult if states could just ignore one another's courts all the time, right? But there are exceptions. And one of the exceptions, the so-called penal exception, which says that one state doesn't have to carry out the punishments and penalties enforced by other states. And that applies not just to criminal punishments, but to other things too, when essentially a state is using civil penalties to carry out public policy objectives, as opposed to like a standard lawsuit, which would just be between private individuals. So New York is going to lean pretty hard on that exception if it comes to this and say, generally, we do honor judgments from other states, but not this kind of judgment. And that may protect Dr. Carpenter. It may not. It's a very strong legal argument, but we're dealing with a very conservative Supreme Court.
You mentioned there's several shield laws across the country right now. So I guess this might be kind of a side question, but, you know, why fight with New York? Is it just a matter of, you know, this is what came up and this is the case that presented itself? Or is there something about New York's shield law that maybe anti-abortion groups are hoping to target in this?
I don't know, to be honest. I think they definitely wanted to go after a doctor affiliated with the organization that protects Shield doctors in the first instance. There are differences between Shield laws. Some Shield laws, for example, explicitly say they won't enforce certain kinds of judgments because they fall under an exception to the Full Faith and Credit Clause. New York's doesn't. It focuses on these so-called clawback lawsuits, the you sue me, I'll sue you, which isn't going to be as effective a tool when we're talking about Texas, you know, which is harder to sue than a private citizen would be.
Why is Texas harder to sue than a private citizen?
Well, so Texas has what's called sovereign immunity from most lawsuits under the 11th Amendment, which generally means you can't sue a state in federal court unless a certain exception applies. If this were, for example, the gentleman who gave Ken Paxton noticed that this had happened, it was someone who had believed that his partner had a miscarriage when she in fact had an abortion. So if someone like that was suing, they wouldn't be able to say, you can't sue, I'm the government. But the 11th Amendment does provide protection for states under some circumstances, so it'll make it harder for New York's clawback lawsuit to kick in.
So how might this impact the overall landscape that we have for abortion right now, and for telehealth and mifepristone too?
Yeah, it's definitely part of a much broader landscape. It's focused on, I think, what conservative states see as the weakest part of the Shield law regime, which are pills being mailed into conservative states as opposed to patients traveling out of state. It's going to be one of many lawsuits we see and potentially prosecutions like this in the new year, in addition to lobbying of the Trump administration to take steps at the federal level, for example, to disallow telehealth access to abortion medication or to use the Comstock Act, which is a 19th century obscenity law, to essentially block the mailing not just of abortion pills, but any abortion-related paraphernalia.
Yeah, we've talked about the Comstock Act a few times on this show. But, you know, for those who might be hearing about it for the first time, remind us what the Comstock Act is.
The Comstock Act is a zombie law. It was passed in 1873, and it's an obscenity law, so it's unmistakably not just an abortion ban. And it contains language, though, involving the mailing of abortion-related items. It hasn't really ever been interpreted the way it's being interpreted now. That is to say, even in the 1880s, courts would say, well, you know, if a doctor was communicating directly with a patient about abortion, the Comstock Act wouldn't apply. And since the 1930s, it's been interpreted only to apply to the mailing of items for unlawful abortions, which would be, you know, very difficult to enforce if you stop to think about it, because a physician would have a hard time knowing if abortion-related drugs or paraphernalia would be needed to protect patients' life or health or not. So what we're seeing is not just an attempt to get the Trump administration to enforce the Comstock Act, but sort of to reinvent the Comstock Act to be much more of a sweeping prohibition as far as abortion is concerned than it has been understood to be by federal courts for a long time. But the reason we're seeing it, of course, is because abortion opponents don't really believe that Congress is going to pass a new ban. And so this might be a kind of way to shut down access, not just to pills, but potentially to other abortion methods as well.
Mary Ziegler is the Martin Luther King Jr. Professor of Law at the University of California, Davis, and the author of 7 books on the abortion debate in the U.S. You can learn more about her work at law.ucdavis.edu. The holidays may be full of hustle and bustle, but that doesn't mean you can't still enjoy them. A psychologist from SUNY Upstate Medical Center is giving advice on how to protect your mental health during this busy season. WRVO's Jessica Kane has more.
The popular lyrics, "All is calm, all is bright," may not apply to a lot of people over the next few months as those holiday to-do lists pile up. Dr. Rich O'Neill, a clinical psychologist at SUNY Upstate, says stress can be normal this time of year.
One of the main things that happens is we have this huge crunch of additional things to do that we don't usually have in our schedule. And that time crunch alone raises stress.
O'Neill says to fight anxiety, try mindfulness. If someone has a negative thought, they can identify why they're worried and think about what resources they have to fight their concerns. And he says, think about what you can do today to fight stress in the future.
Start working now rather than Christmas Eve going out shopping crazily, running around, you know, looking for stuff, and be realistic around your money as well. Do a budget.
If you have big plans with family and friends, O'Neill says think about simplifying your shopping and budget by trying something like Secret Santa. And if you have a big gathering planned, you can keep the tone positive by avoiding controversial topics.
If somebody insists, I say, look, I don't talk about politics and religion. I want us to be here and just have a good time together. That's my goal. Have fun. I love you. I know you love me. So let's do something fun.
O'Neill suggests keeping more neutral topics in mind that you can introduce, like kids, the weather, or sports teams you both enjoy. On the other hand, loneliness can also be a big strain on mental health during the holidays.
There are a huge number of people who are alone. And then if you don't want to be alone, you don't like that, you can structure things into your life so you can have time with people on those holidays. Or do other things,
including volunteering, which is known to boost mental health. And O'Neill says, don't forget the season is supposed to be about joy. So think about your values. For him, it's family.
I want to be with the grandkids, right? So I orient my life around that and move things out of the way that prevent you from engaging in things that you like.
For WRVO News, I'm Jessica Kane.
As you just heard, the holidays are a difficult time of year for a lot of people, and it can be hard to enjoy it yourself and sing songs about how war is over when war is explicitly not over in many parts of the world, and we have plenty of political and social tension here at home. I think we hear a lot about how empathy can be emotionally exhausting and how we need to back away from social media and the news for our own mental well-being, But what if empathy is actually a superpower? What if we actually need more of it? Our last guest today has been called the godmother of the empath movement. Dr. Judith Orloff is a psychiatrist and self-described empath on staff at the University of California, Los Angeles. She also has her own private practice treating other highly sensitive people and is a New York Times best-selling author on the subject. Her latest book is called The Genius of Empathy: Practical Skills to Heal Your Sensitive Self, Your Relationship, and the World.
The genius of empathy is so important to me because we're at a critical time in history and in emotional development that we need to find a way to find empathy for ourselves and for others and to make this world a better place, our personal world and the greater world. And empathy, which is the ability to open your heart and be kind to yourself and to be kind to others and to be patient and tolerant. All of these skills are just so important to learn right now.
All right. You know, I think the definition of empathy is maybe a good place to start here, too, because you touched on it. And I've always thought of it as, you know, just like the ability to put yourself in someone else's shoes, I guess. But what does empathy actually look like? You know, what are some examples that we can point to?
The definition of empathy is the ability to tenderly tune into other people and feel what they're going through. If they're going through sadness, if they're going through happiness, you have the ability to resonate with them and connect to them. Empathy is a connector. And so an example of empathy would be, let's say a friend loses a child and your heart goes out to the friend. That's a form of empathy. Or let's say a friend's relative is graduating high school. It's a time to be happy and have empathy, you know, for that graduation and enjoy with your friend what's going on. So it's a form of connection, and it's a connection also to yourself. In The Genius of Empathy, I write about self-empathy, what you say to yourself at 3 a.m. in the morning when your mind is swirling around and around with all kinds of traumas or fears, or you can't figure out a solution and it's getting nowhere. And so at that point, it's time to have empathy for yourself and say, this is enough. You've done enough today. You've done a good job in a very difficult situation, let's say at work. And so now is the time just to be kind to yourself and take a deep breath and go to sleep. And so empathy can change the biochemistry of our bodies. It actually increases the endorphins. It increases the feel-good chemicals. It increases dopamine, which is the pleasure hormone. So it's only positive for our systems.
I really like the way that you talk about it. You know, you don't talk about it like it's a quality that's totally locked in or as something that, you know, you either do or don't have at birth. Like, you can learn empathy and practice being more empathetic. And then, you know, you can also shrink back and take care of yourself more when needed too.
Yes, absolutely. I supervise psychiatric residents at UCLA and teach them to bring empathy into their practices with their patients. And so it's a very teachable skill. And in the book, I say what a practical skill it is and how we can develop it in a variety of situations. How do you have empathy without burning out? Let's say your relative is ill and you're sitting with them. How do you have empathy without just going into depression or feeling so burned out you can't handle it anymore? So these are skills that you can learn. It's important to have your heart open. But what empaths do, what people with empathy, deep empathy do, is they tend to become emotional sponges and they take on the problems of the world, including their friends, including their family. And so part of the skill set of empathy is to learn how not to do that, to learn how to give, but also set boundaries and allow yourself to feel healthy without burning out by giving too much.
Tell me a little bit more about protecting yourself as an empath, because, you know, this is a particularly tough time of year for a lot of people. It's a season of giving too, though, and you want to help the people you love and be there for them as much as you can. How do you strike that balance of being empathetic without basically, like you said, becoming a sponge?
Exactly. And that's the skill set that goes along with empathy. Empathy is considered by some a weakness. And it's only a weakness if you don't know how to increased your skills of setting boundaries, of saying this relative has drained me every holiday season for the last 10 years, and I'm not going to allow it this time. I'm going to limit the time I speak to them. I'm going to not get into it with them at the dining room table. I'm going to sit somewhere else at the table if I have that option. And I'm not going to give my energy to this person again. So it's a conscious decision that you make. And it's very empowering because it works. And you're not arguing with somebody. And the where people go wrong with empathy is they tend to get into a combative argument if they're triggered. And that's not a way to set boundaries. It's very important to say, you know, perhaps I hear what you're saying and I'll give it some thought and leave it at that, especially if people over the holidays or any time have different belief systems than you do, and they're very adamant about certain beliefs. If you remember anything, remember not to get into it with them. You know, just say, I hear what you're saying, I'll give it some thought. And that's all you have to do. But it's important that you don't get triggered, because the moment you're triggered, you get drained.
How do we help each other with empathy? Or do we? Like, if someone you know is being pretty harsh lately, or you're just constantly butting heads with them and they just don't seem to get it, is it worth telling them, like, hey, I think maybe this is something to work on? Or is it more empathetic to just leave them be, I guess? Like, I can't see a conversation like that always going very well.
It is if you think someone's open to it. I want to say that most people do have empathy, varying degrees of empathy. But if you're dealing with a narcissist, and I have a whole chapter on narcissists, sociopaths, and psychopaths in the Genius of Empathy, these are people with empathy deficient disorders. And they don't have the same empathy that other people have. And it's so hard to conceptualize of that, because you think everybody should have empathy, but they're not wired that way. They're more motivated by power rather than love. And so I wouldn't bring it up with them is my answer. But if you have a nice friend or a nice relative and they, you know, are basically loving people, it's good to bring it up with them a little bit. You know, or I feel such empathy for you that you're going through this now. You know, for you just to say something like that, because people basically want to be seen, they want to be heard, they want to be valued. That's what people want. And it's a beautiful thing to give somebody that, because they don't get it very often. And that's why I love empathy so much, because it's a gift that you can give yourself to take the pressure off, to get all those negative voices out of your head and be kinder to yourself, to learn how to deal with people who aren't that nice and make the conversation short, rather than get into it with them and subject yourself to such damaging interactions. So empathy has a wide range. And yes, I would bring it up for those who you think would understand. And sometimes children really understand this. You know, they understand, you know, honey, you're doing such a wonderful job. And they go, oh, thank you. And it's just a beautiful way to treat people and yourself.
Your book gives practical skills for healing yourself, your relationships, and the world. Tell me more about that last part. Why is empathy important for our broader communities?
Oh, the third part of the book is about how empathy can improve the world and our greater communities. What it does is that it allows you to have a sense of connection to the people around you, and to be able to care about what's going on with them, to be able to listen to people you might not agree with. And I suggest people practice that every day, to have conversations with people you don't agree with, so you could develop that skill. You know, now it's connected with adversity. But as opposed to just listening, if somebody agrees with you, fine. If someone agrees with you, doesn't agree with you, that's fine too. I mean, in a way. But it helps a sense of connection. And even though you might not know people 3,000 miles away, if you sit and hold good thoughts for the people in that region, and you're able to send the love and the kindness to them. You might call it prayer, you might call it positive visualizations, whatever you're comfortable with. That love and that energy and empathy can travel. And sometimes people feel it. And it's an uplifting energy. Empathy is totally uplifting. If I say to you, you know, I hear what happened, you know, and I am totally with you. What can I do to help? You know, that kind of thing. It really helps people. And so that sense of connection that empathy can bring can weave the world together. Because if you know other people are trying to understand you, that's something very positive, as opposed to feeling depressed or lonely or isolation, which is so toxic. And especially around the holidays, there's so many people who can feel isolated, you know, where they don't have families, you know, or they don't have places to go that are positive and nurturing. And that's really common, or they're rushing around. And so empathy is about, you know, using this holiday season perhaps to explore it like you never have before. You know, how can you say nicer things to yourself? How can you slow yourself down? How can you look around at nature and the stars at night and this beautiful planet we're on to gain perspective? You know, how can you take the time to do these things for yourself, which will only make you happier, healthier, and calm your biochemistry, and your vagus nerve will be activated, because that's the relaxation nerve, and it will just help everything just slow down and turn down the temperature on things. Empathy is a healing emotion. And so the more you can get in touch with it, the better you'll be and the happier you'll be, and other people will connect with you more.
You know, we just got out of a pretty intense election season, and, you know, we have a very politically and socially divided country right now. I guess, what advice or missions do you have for empaths right now?
I think because it's such a complex situation, you need to stick with the community that you have that does share those values. If somebody doesn't share those values, it's going to be very hard to get them to go in that direction. So I wouldn't try at this point, but I would strengthen the circles that we have now. I would show gratitude for the people around you and everything that we've all gone through in the past 4 years, you know, which has been extremely traumatic for many people. And how do you keep it small right now? Try to find people who can support you, you can support them, and you can grow larger groups with time. But we need to regroup now, you know, as a world, as a civilization. And for me, you know, I think it's very important to be clear about your values. You know, my values before this election, after the election, it's for empathy, it's for kindness, it's for compassion, it's for getting over hatred, however you do it. So this election didn't change my values. I just keep going on my path. It might be harder to express it, you know, especially the people you don't like and the people who are, you know, not behaving ethically or something like that. But for now, I would focus on, you know, the loving people around you and create a positive circle, or your animals. You know, the animals are such unconditionally loving, empathic beings. To be able to do that and give yourself some downtime. It's important, if you have empathy and you tune in to a lot of different things, that you give yourself downtime, that you just take a walk, that you look up at the stars, that you meditate, if you do meditate, and calm your system down, and really focus on what you have to be grateful for. And then once you get these values in place, we can all deal with the bigger picture. But I think people are just so spent right now. They need to regroup. They need to replenish. And that's what the genius of empathy is.
Dr. Judith Orloff is a psychiatrist and empath on staff at the University of California, Los Angeles. She also has her own private practice treating empaths and highly sensitive people. Her latest book is The Genius of Empathy: Practical Skills to Heal Your Sensitive Self, Your Relationships, and the World. You can learn more about her at drjudithorloff.com. Thanks for joining us for this week's 51%. 51% is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio based in Albany, New York. It's produced and hosted by me, Jesse King. Our associate producer is Madeline Reynolds, and our theme is Lolita by the Albany-based artist Girl Blue. Just a reminder that you can listen to 51% anytime at our website, wamcpodcasts.org, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can stay in the loop on all of WAMC's shows by signing up for our weekly newsletter, Airwaves, at wamc.org. We hope you'll join us next week. Until then, I'm Jesse King for 51%.
I was every single girl, I was nobody else, I was so sure of myself. I was 15 and a half, he was a hollow laugh. And I lost my cool somewhere along the way. A nightmare down the hallway, I had to learn how to look away. I lost my cool. Sweet bells in little